This is a podcast from the University of Manchester's Jodrell Bank Centre for Astrophysics. For more information, see jodcast.net.
In the October edition of the Jodcast, we discussed the upcoming Schiaparelli lander component of the joint European-Russian mission to Mars, the ExoMars Trace Gas Orbiter mission. It was anticipated with some trepidation. Humankind's record for landing successfully on the surface of Mars has not been good. Of the 44 missions recorded by NASA, only 20 are considered to be successful or partially successful. The roll call of failures include the Mars Polar Orbiter and Beagle 2, which was a partial success as even though the lander failed, the Mars Orbiter Express sent much useful data back. Sadly, the ExoMars mission will also have to be classified as partially successful. While the orbiter was successfully placed in a high-altitude holding orbit around Mars, the lander impacted at high speed on the surface. Getting to the Martian surface is tougher than on Earth, as the atmosphere is 100 times thinner. Typically, space probes use aerobraking to slow themselves down. Friction from the atmosphere then converts kinetic energy into heat energy. This isn't as effective in the Martian atmosphere compared to Earth, and means that the lander will have to be travelling at supersonic speeds when the parachute deploys. Previous Mars landers have used a mixture of heat shields, parachutes, retrorockets and airbags to get themselves safely to the surface. The Schiaparelli lander was designed as a technology testbed for later European Space Agency missions to the Red Planet. In addition to the supersonic parachute system, it made use of a guidance and control system based on a Doppler radar altimeter sensor and onboard inertial measurement units. ESA scientists were as interested in the data produced in the descent as they were in whether or not the lander arrived successfully on the surface. The early phases of the descent proceeded according to plan. Aerobraking slowed the lander from 21,000 kilometers an hour down to 1,700 kilometers an hour. At this point, the parachute successfully deployed. 5 minutes and 22 seconds after the initial entry to the Martian atmosphere, at an altitude of 1.7 kilometers above the surface, the parachute, along with the rear cover, was to be jettisoned from the lander. At this point, thrusters should have fired for 30 seconds, bringing the lander's speed down to 4 kilometers an hour, just 2 meters above the surface of Mars. The lander would then drop down to the surface, where a carbon fibre cushion would absorb the low-speed impact. Data from the lander suggests that the thruster phase did not go according to plan. Instead of firing for 30 seconds, the thrusters fired for just 3 to 4 seconds. After this, the lander dropped down to the Martian surface in freefall and impacted at a speed of around 300 kilometres an hour. Images from the Mars Reconnaissance Orbiter of the landing site show two new features. One is believed to be the parachute and rear cover, the other the impact site of the lander, about 1 kilometer north of the parachute. It is thought that fuel in the thrusters tanks exploded on impact, completely destroying the lander. The impact site was only 4.5 kilometers from the intended landing site and was well within the nominal landing ellipse. Any fall from a great height can be considered to be successful up to the point of impact. This can actually be said for the Schiaparelli lander, which sent back 600 megabytes of data on the descent up to the point of impact. This data will be used in later missions, including the ExoMars rover, due to be launched in 2020. On a positive note, the ExoMars Trace Gas Orbiter will be placed into a circular orbit 250 miles above Mars after calibration tests completed in November. It will then be searching for gases such as methane to establish whether it is produced in the atmosphere as a result of geological or biological activity. If the methane is accompanied by propane or ethane, this may be a marker that indicates that it originates from a biological source. If it is seen with sulfur dioxide, then it's more likely to originate from geological activity. In addition, the ExoMars Trace Gas Orbiter will act as a communications relay for future ESA missions to Mars through to the year 2022. Jodcast listeners who are of a certain age or movie buffs will record Steve McQueen's first starring role in that wonderful film, The Blob. In this 1950s drive-in movie staple, a blob from outer space, looking suspiciously like strawberry jelly, invades the small US town of Downington, Pennsylvania, and proceeds to engulf and devour its unfortunate inhabitants. The end credit of the film is simply the end with a question mark, suggesting that maybe the story wasn't over, and maybe there would be more incidents involving the blob. That question mark can now be answered. It was the end of the film, and there is no such thing as a blob which will invade us from outer space and devour any of us. However, I know that all of us at Jodcast Central felt a strange frisson of fear when hearing of scientists' attempts to understand the origins of giant blobs in outer space. An international team, headed by Jim Geach from the Centre of Astrophysics Research of the University of Hertfordshire, have used data from the Atacama Large Millimeter Array, ALMA, alongside data from the multi-unit spectroscopic explorer instrument mounted on the Very Large Telescope in northern Chile, to gain an understanding of Lyman Alpha Blob 1, Lab 1, one of 30 Lyman Alpha blobs discovered since the year 2000. Lab 1 is one of the largest structures in the universe, being 400,000 light-years in diameter. It is 11.5 billion light-years away, so we're seeing it at an early age in the life of the universe. The radiation from the blob is originally from the ultraviolet part of the spectrum, but this is cosmologically red-shifted to the visible part of the spectrum. Now, it's surprising that an object made of diffuse clouds of hydrogen should be so bright that they're visible at such large distances. The team have been trying to understand the mechanisms that led to the emission of such large amounts of energy. Now, any astrophysicist worth their salt, when faced with huge amounts of energy, will normally say supermassive black holes. And in this case, they will be right and wrong. Early X-ray observations of Lab 1 did show a supermassive black hole at the centre of a large active galaxy, which is embedded in a bubble of hydrogen gas. Observations from ALMA have since shown at least two large galaxies surrounded by smaller galaxies. At some point in their future, and our past, these galaxies will combine to form a giant elliptical galaxy. All of these are regions of extraordinary star formation. Over 100 times as many stars are being formed in these regions compared to the Milky Way. Computer models lead the team to suggestion that the radiation from these young, hot stars, which is principally in the ultraviolet region, is scattered by the hydrogen in the clouds surrounding the galaxies. The radiation from these clouds is polarized, and the team used this finding to confirm the predictions made by the model. When we look at Lab 1, we're looking at the building blocks of the formation of a large, massive elliptical galaxy. Galaxy formation has been an issue for cosmologists for many years, and this provides another piece in that jigsaw puzzle. Sadly, Jim Geach's team has not been able to confirm or deny that the cloud tastes or smells of strawberry. In December 1995, the Hubble Space Telescope spent 10 days taking a picture of a small portion of space in the Ursa Major constellation. The Hubble Deep Field image covered a tiny part of the night sky, just 2.6 arc minutes on each side, and it revealed around 3,000 galaxies. When combined with the ultra-deep field images, astronomers were able to conclude that the number of galaxies in the observable universe is huge, over 200 billion galaxies. Christopher Conslice and his team at the University of Nottingham have applied techniques to these images to report that there are now 10 times more galaxies than originally thought. One of the new techniques was to build a three-dimensional model of the universe from the original images. They then applied computer models to the galaxies at different distances to infer the presence of smaller, fainter galaxies. From this, they arrived at an estimated 2 trillion galaxies. This has gone some way towards solving a problem raised by the original deep field research. The projected 2 billion galaxies from the initial research were not enough to account for the predicted mass of the universe. 2 trillion is a step in the direction expected by theorists, but there is still a discrepancy that the team are investigating. The deep field images show galaxies 13 billion light-years away. This displays the galaxies that they were 13 billion years ago. Since that time, these small, faint galaxies will have merged to form the universe with the fewer galaxies that we now see in our immediate surroundings. Astrophysicists are now waiting for the launch and deployment of Hubble's follow-up, the James Webb Space Telescope. This instrument should be able to see even further back to the beginning of the universe, to a time when these galaxies were being formed.